You're listening to the We Lead Well podcast, where well-being matters. This episode is brought to you in partnership with Transform Education Coaching, headteacherchat.com and the Teach Well Alliance. Enjoy the show. Welcome to the latest episode of the We Lead Well podcast. I'm Vicky Maguire. I work with school leaders with the aim of improving their well-being and that of all their staff, whether that's through teaching and learning coaching, one-to-one leadership coaching, or the group coaching programmes that I run for women leaders. I'm a passionate advocate for coaching and how it can significantly improve well-being. And today on the show, I've interviewed Bianca Greenhalgh. Bianca is in her first year as head teacher at the Gatwick School, which is an all-through school. And in this interview today, she is brutally honest about what the reality of being new to headship is and the challenges that that brings. One of the things that really shines in this interview with Bianca is the importance of authenticity in leadership. And that is something that is just so important if you are a leader. The question of how do you lead authentically from your own values, morals, and belief system. And I think you're going to really enjoy this interview with Bianca because she really gets to grips with exactly what that means. Enjoy the interview. Bianca Greenhalgh, welcome to the We Lead Well podcast. It's great to have you with us. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you, and it's great to be here.
Well, we've got the nice weather anyway, so it's
going to be quite warm today.
Yeah, it's going to be a
nice going into the weekend.
A scorcher, yes. So do you want to start off by just, for the listener, giving them a bit of an insight into your background in education and how you got to where you are now?
Yes, of course. So I actually didn't start in education until I was 30.
Right.
I had a life before teaching. I did a performing arts degree, dance and performing arts degree. Loved dancing, but decided it wasn't going to provide me with the lifestyle that I was accustomed to. So decided so fell into catering and absolutely loved it. It was like a performance every day. So that sort of being really busy and by the end of it, everyone having had a really good time. Really, it was because I had my son at 25, so quite young in those days.
I had my son at 26, and okay, I felt like a young mother.
Well, I felt like a young mother at that point, I guess, because it was around the time that women were kind of career first and later. So a lot of the women that I was mixing with within those groups were in their 30s. And I think it just got to a point. The thing is, my mum had always said I'd be really good at teaching, I wasn't ready for that then. And I said one day maybe, but I wanted to have some life experience behind me. I always felt that I wanted to make the difference. I've always liked the idea. I love working with young people, the full spectrum of young people, but I've always liked the idea of supporting those to have opportunities that perhaps otherwise wouldn't have had them. And those young people are perhaps from disadvantaged backgrounds that needed people to believe. Yeah. So I did a master's around 29 just to get my head back into the game, and then followed the GTP route when I was 30, and in that year separated from my husband at the time. So that was quite a challenging year, but I carried on with that, so I was in teaching really to become a head teacher. I did say at the beginning I wanted to be a head teacher because I felt that although I think you can have agency in the classroom, not always have the autonomy to make decisions that make the difference. So I absolutely sort of had that idea that I would be a head teacher by the time I was 45. And that was sort of my goal, I suppose. So started off as a dance specialist. I had moved around the country a little bit to enable me to do it, but that's been a bit of a life choice as well as a career choice. And ended up on the South Coast. Started my teaching career training in Basingstoke, lived in London for a bit, so worked in Tottenham, which were great days. I really enjoyed working there, and then down to the South Coast. So inclusion has been my background in terms of my career journey. Although, you know, for me, inclusion is about teaching and learning and every child being able to access the curriculum and the learning that's right for them. And so, yeah, started my headship in September. So, of course, I went through assistant head vice principal of a large school and then head teacher here at the Gatwick School in September.
And how are you finding it?
It's been an interesting first year. I always knew it would be a challenge. I'm lucky enough in lots of ways that my son's now 22, so I'm not having to balance it with looking after him. He's a grown up now and doing his own thing. I've loved it. I still love it. I absolutely have not lost my sense of humour. still smiling and still standing just. But it has been because of COVID. You know, you have the intricacies anyway of starting a new job, and of course starting a new job as a head, you know, where the buck stops with you, is a different level of leadership. I think the biggest difference is that it's the social responsibility, I think, because we can all put systems and processes in place and teaching and learning and pedagogy and the right curriculum and all of those, you know, all of, you know, getting the right things and the right people in place is really important. But I think the thing that's perhaps had my head in my hands over the year has been where there's a social unrest outside of school and how that's sort of polarized in school, and the responsibility of that for the fully rounded child, for the fully rounded community that basically I'm in charge of and that, you know, look up to me to support them.
It's a huge responsibility to be a head, isn't it? I think back to when I took on my deputy head teacher role, I probably still had ambitions to become a head. And I think I was put off slightly when I saw the head who started when I started as a deputy. So he was new as well. And I saw how much he took on his shoulders in terms of that responsibility, and not only for the social aspects, it is a responsibility in terms of learning and academic results, isn't it? But also the pastoral aspect to it and the safeguarding. And the amount of responsibility, actually, I found it a little bit overwhelming, and perhaps that's one of the things that put me off. So how do you cope with that amount of pressure on you, knowing that you've got so much responsibility?
I think accept the help and support that's there for you, because I think there is that. I think for women in particular, you know, the perfectionism and the, you know, need to kind of get it all right all of the time is there. And I'm not saying it doesn't exist for men in leadership, but I think it is very specifically there for women. And Charlotte Woolley writes it about it in The Lost Girls. And I think how do I manage it? I trust my team. You know, I rely on them to. I give them trust, but I give them autonomy. You know, obviously there are things that I want to be done in a certain way, but you know, bringing other leaders on to develop areas of the school that they can have ownership over means that, you know, that they're passionate about it, and therefore you can trust that job to be done and just guide where needed. And sometimes you need to give a directive, but I like to work collaboratively and have a collegiate team working together. But also the support that is around you. You know, you are a human being, and it's okay to be a human being. Certainly in the last couple of weeks, I've got two colleagues in particular that have really supported. You know, when I've been in information overload of just so many different things that were sort of requiring a high level of emotional energy in a very short space of time. So as a result of that, I think, what is it? I've got a coach as well, so that's really supportive. Yeah. She highlighted that you know, that last 3 weeks of a year for heads is quite a tough one, because it's twitchy, isn't it? Everyone's getting tired, just trying to plan for September and get everything in place and tied up and you know, keeping everyone happy. To be able to lean on those around me in those moments and to show my vulnerable has been really beneficial, because I think for everybody else, they've needed to see you know, the smile and the sort of let's get through this together towards the end of term. So certainly, you know, coach helps. You know, I think local heads, I've got a really supportive local heads group. My team around me are very supportive. So just being honest about what you need from them at that time, it is good to work with that. And try not to do everything all at once, and try not to please everyone all at once. You know, if you, you know, because we have lives outside of school. I'm privileged enough to have a partner who is very supportive and doesn't ask a great deal of me. And so very much, you know, so I can very much share, you know, if I'm needing the space, I can ask for it. And I think we need to be honest and open about that.
So many things have come up for me there in the things that you've said. So the first one was, I think when you were talking about your ambitions, and you said when you started teaching, you had the ambition to be a head. And I think lots of women in teaching start off that way, probably when they're in their 20s or early 30s. And then for some reason, they seem to change their minds. You know, I speak to women in my coaching groups when I do the women leader coaching groups, and lots of them who I ask, who seem to me to be brilliant candidates for headship, but say, no, it's not for me, or I don't want to do it. And I wondered what you think it is that perhaps makes women change their minds from having that ambition initially to eventually saying, sort of when the time approaches, when they might be really seriously thinking about it, to change their minds.
I suppose women have children, don't they? And I suppose that is going to have an impact. I was lucky enough to have opportunities where my son was cared for through his own education, which gave me the space and time and the hours to be able to put into work and then just be available to him after that. I think it's the inflexibility of school structures. You know, although part-time flexible work is supported, it not by all schools, and you know it does bring, you know, it brings its benefits definitely, because you know, ultimately you get quite a lot of discretionary effort from two people that are doing one person's job. So you actually, you know, really, in terms of any currency you get from that, you often get more because you've got two people that are really passionate.
And because they can give more as well, can't they? Because they're not as tired as someone
who's
working full time probably as well.
So I think there is a benefit there that perhaps we don't tap into enough in schools because of, you know, because of the, I suppose, the inflexibility sometimes of timetables and the issues that it might cause having too many part-timers and that sort of thing. And it does require a certain level of energy and resilience, and people prioritise, I think. And partly because actually what we haven't got in leadership is, you know, certainly we haven't got in headship is many female heads, really. I mean, I haven't got the statistics. I should do because I'm a networking.
I think it's about 40, 60% split men, 60% women, 40%.
So it's better than it.
Maybe
it's better than it was, but I think last
But it's time, the other way around when you look at teachers. So less than 40% of teachers are men.
It's not proportionate. I think the last bit of data that I did see, it was still in the 30%.
Yeah,
something like that, and it looked like it only really moved.
I think I'm rounding up. It's not.
Yeah, it was somewhere around between 33. It was somewhere around 33%, and I just remember, but it only increased.
No, you're right. It is. It's 33.67. Yeah.
Yeah. And but it only increased since the last time that there was a data collection, about 20, 30 years ago. So it's shifted about 3%.
Yeah.
So I think part of it is to do with the fact that there are few women in leadership, and therefore that the role model, I suppose, the accessibility, and it's not my quotation, so forgive me because I can't remember who said it originally, but you know, if you can't see it, you can't be it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not just for women, that's also for black men and women, but particularly for black women as well, within that portion of heads. So I think that's part of the issue. It's systemic.
I probably said on the show before, if I could do a co-headship
where I did 50% of the role and shared it with someone else who, you know, there's work to go into that, isn't there, in terms of, do you have the same values and ethics, and maybe it works if you're not similar in your approach, maybe I think you'd have to explore it. But I would do a co-headship and, you know, do 3 days a week. I would definitely, that is something I would do, but there aren't many around, are there?
There aren't. It does exist, because I know of a local school where they had that model as an interim measure. I'm not sure what the final outcome was when they appointed, but it does exist and it can work. It can work. But I think, like, you know, like I say, the opportunities aren't necessarily there. And I think our systems, our structures don't enable often.
I think one of the things that I read about this, and it's different, I just do want to point out that they're the high school figures that we're referring to. Primary school, it's different, but the same again, it's disproportionate compared to the number of teachers in the classroom being female and the men in leadership roles. And then the dog barked outside and I completely lost my train of thought. But yeah, that's what I was going to say. So I read that as well, because when you mentor someone, you mentor someone who is similar to yourself or someone who you see a lot of yourself in, because there are more male head teachers, there tend to be then more men on senior leadership teams and they tend to mentor more men than women. And that can be a problem as well. So we need more heads mentoring female leaders, don't we?
There was a program for that, but I don't think it continued. I know the DfE had a program for women mentoring women in leadership.
Yeah, there was something with coaching, wasn't there?
And
I've looked at that and I can't find any evidence. Now, you said you have a coach and coaching has helped you.
Yeah.
And I wondered how that has helped you. One of the things that I think a lot of people might think about coaching but don't really fully understand how powerful it can be, and really sometimes only understand the power of it when they experience it. So it's like a bit of a vicious circle with it, isn't it? So how has coaching helped you, and also how have you accessed it, because it can be quite expensive, can't it?
Yeah, it can be, and I'm quite lucky that my trust have paid for it. Because I didn't do an MPQH before I started teaching. Before I started my headship, I decided I would, you know, because it's not essential now, I decided not to. I thought if I didn't get headship, then I might, by the end of the year that I did, that I might then think about embarking on that in the following year. However, I got the headship. So I asked for one because I've always valued coaching. In my previous school, we were sort of moving towards a coaching culture. In this school this year, we've had coaching conversations as part of triads and, you know, keeping the dialogue about teaching and learning live on a regular basis, which has been really good. So I think coaching, sometimes people think it's a bit fluffy. Mm. My coach is definitely not that. she's challenging. To really sort of dig deep and to the root of any of the issues or the focus areas that I go to her with. She really pushes at me and challenges me. And it's good because the relationship we've got is it does flip between coaching and mentoring. But I think most coaches do sometimes we just don't have the answers in us and we need a bit of a steer. It's helped because, you know, in those moments where you just need a bit of clarity and just to be brought down, back down to earth, if you're feeling quite heightened, it just helps you to really think that through, because quite often, you know, that you're working at such high pace and so many, such a diverse range of things that you have to deal with, that having a coach can really, really help you center what your core purpose is or what the core issue is. And then think about how you're going to deal with it and address it.
Another of the things that came out of what you were saying was you mentioned something that you referred to as emotional energy. Mm. And I feel like that hits the nail on the head in terms of why teachers need the holidays, because it's a job that requires so much emotional energy and a lot of mental energy as well. And I think the two combined come together sometimes to create sheer exhaustion in people. And, you know, now the teaching profession is on its knees, isn't it, in terms of never have they needed the summer holidays more than they needed this year. I wonder how, as a head teacher, you approach that aspect of being ahead and the well-being of your staff in terms of how you can support them to keep their emotional energy up.
Well, I work for the Aurora Academy Trust, and they are that's our school's part of the trust, and we have a well-being lead, so she within the trust, so she very much supports the schools to ensure that we are looking after our staff well-being. We regularly ask colleagues to fill in surveys so that we get to the core of any of the issues that they have, so that we can try and address any of their needs really through our CPD or the sort of the things that we are doing in school. We do a lot of wellbeing work with our young people. Around Wellbeing Month, we did lots of wellbeing walks. Colleagues are involved in that. We look at as an openness and a transparency where we can. You can't always. Sometimes you just have to make difficult decisions. But I think by working collaboratively with our colleagues, that, you know, I think sometimes the sort of the sense of autonomy over some of the decision making helps, because if people feel like they're being done to, that's often where a lot of the stress comes from. Certainly over this year, we talked to departments about things like marking and feedback, because marking, marking books, that's one of the heavy loads for teachers. And we make sure that departments decide what's the most effective, efficient way of feeding back and marking books. And certainly during COVID period, we said that there's not an expectation for marking, but we do expect to see evidence for feedback, and how you do that within your department is up to you. Electronic would probably be sensible, and I think that cuts down. So we're always looking at ways to be more efficient. In meetings, we have conversations about, we always ask the question, what's the impact going to be on colleagues if we were to do this now? We're flexible, beginning of the year, you've always got an ARR calendar, you've got your sort of assessment calendar, your reporting calendar, you will look at your calendar for the year. And it's not been unknown in this job or my previous role for us to actually realise when you're actually in it that there's a bottleneck.
Yeah.
and rather than sort of forging forward because it's in the plan, to reassess and prioritise and drop something if it's appropriate to make sure that we're looking after people, really. My union, I work really closely with my union representative here, so that if there are any big changes, I'll try and talk it through with him first so that he can think about the implications it might have, or certainly for example 1265, shared that with him to share with his team before I finalized it to publish, so they could ask questions of it before we got there. So there are a whole range of things to do. It's a bit tokenistic, cakes in the staff room, but we have well-being treats, at certain points where we know people are starting to feel tired and just want to grab themselves something sweet or nice, I suppose what we also do is we regularly think about what else we can do in terms of well-being. So It's a journey.
I think one of the key things two key things that you talk about there from my perspective are the impact. And not only thinking about the impact on, if we do this, what will the impact on staff be? But if we do this, what impact will there be on pupils? Because a lot of times in schools, I feel like things are done and then they're being done and there's no impact on the pupils. And you constantly have to be, assessing whether there's an impact on pupils but an impact on staff. It's like a bit of a triangulation process, yeah. Isn't it? You've got to look at the impact on your leaders, your staff and yeah. your pupils from the things that you're doing. So that's really, really important.
And if people have got big, I do have high expectations. I'm asking a lot of people, but we all have that moment of overwhelm, and if if colleagues get to a place where they've got something to do, but, you know, deadlines looming and they're feeling like they can't fit it in and they hit that point, well, then where we can, we create space. Yeah. Just say, go home at lunchtime. Just if it helps you to go home at lunchtime, work into the afternoon. Go home at lunchtime and do what you need to do with that space and time, as long as it's done by the time.
And that's, you know, a trust thing.
I'm not going to. Yeah, it is.
And I'll come back to that in a minute, because the other thing that you said was about the calendar and your sort of your ARR calendar and being flexible in that, that it's not set in stone. If you notice there's a bottleneck, because in a lot of the schools I worked, it was like every single year we came upon that same bottleneck and we were like, how has this happened again? Because it happened last year and then we thought we were being really careful when we planned out the calendar and then we end up in this bottleneck again. So it's really important that you keep that calendar flexible so that it can respond to the well-being of your staff and that you can make it a sort of a live document, I suppose.
Before Bianca and I continue our conversation about how you can make your school calendar a live document, I'd like to tell you a little bit about our partner, Head Teacher Chat. Head Teacher Chat discusses lots of topics, from how to support pupils with learning, how to support parents, and the many issues that come with leading a school. The aim of Head Teacher Chat is to support head teachers and school leaders who are in a challenging and often lonely role. They do this by offering lots of information for schools to tap into. For example, they have lots of fantastic education companies on their database for leaders to discover, as well as leadership templates to download. They've written product reviews for leaders who are looking for products for their school. And this year, they've even launched the very first school leader planner, especially designed to help leaders to be productive and organised. If you'd like to hear more about Head Teacher Chat, you can find them on their website at www.headteacherchat.com. Head Teacher Chat, it's what head teachers are talking about. Now let's get back to the interview.
Yeah, I mean, it's planned for, so people know what's coming, you know, but if, you know, if we get to a point where there's a deadline, but it actually we've now got trust review for 2 days and it sits right in the middle of the deadline, well, then we extend the deadline.
Yeah,
it's not that we get rid of it because it's still important, but that we just give people a bit more time.
And that's the thing, if you've got a calendar, you can't just get rid of the things willy-nilly, can you? And say, oh, we're not going to do that now because we don't have time. But it's just about having that flexibility to start shuffling things around a bit to take the pressure off stuff, because there are pinch points in a school year, aren't there, when staff feel under considerable amounts of pressure. And I suppose as a leader, it's understanding that when you're reaching one of those, if there's anything you can do just to ease the pressure, then you do it. So you talked about trust and autonomy. Now, there are things that come up time and time again on the podcast. And I interview probably people on the podcast who are more progressive and future focused and trying to think about how we can change things in schools for the better. But I feel like we're moving from a very rigid monitoring and evaluation sort of, you know, that sort of accountability system to one of more trust and trying to create more autonomy in staff. Because I think you said at the start that you wanted to be ahead so that you would have that autonomy to make those decisions. And it's a bit of a different type of decision, but for staff to have autonomy over what they do. And you put the two things together, trust and autonomy. So can you tell me a little bit about why you feel like they're so important in terms of looking after your staff?
I think you've got to strike a balance, because, you know, I think you've got to, you know, we are still accountable as heads, and I'm currently in that interim period where, you know, we don't do lesson observations as part of an appraisal process. I'm working closely with Vivian Porritt on her improve not prove model for school improvement planning. So, you know, we're not just trying to find three arbitrary performance management targets that look like they're separate, but actually, you know, have a project that will probably incorporate all three, but you're getting some real welly behind one thing, you know.
Yep.
And it really definitely feeds into the priorities we have in terms of school improvement, and people, you know, people can then own those. You know, there's a process of doing it. It's very new, and you almost have to unlearn to relearn how to sort of present it and think about how you're going to make the difference. But So I think, so, you know, we're in a place where that's my philosophy, my ideal moving forward. I think we, you know, we still have learning walks. We have work looks. We have all of that level of scrutiny that we need to keep an eye that policy and procedures are being followed. But it's trying to move away from that. Formal lesson observations haven't done for a very long time. Learning walks, yes. So it's sort of a learning walk. You would walk around and you would expect 10 minutes. And if there's a concern about what you've seen in that lesson, then you might go back for a sort of what we're calling a spotlight for another 20 minutes, you know, because then, and I think what we're moving towards is then being able to, how do we capture those conversations to then make sure that there are actions in place through middle leaders to support colleagues? Because, you know, we all have, again, we all have those moments where, you know, where perhaps we've left that marking for that group for quite some time, and if it gets, doesn't get picked, if there are no monitoring processes in place and it doesn't get picked up, then potentially we're letting somebody drift. And I always see it as a supportive strategy, any monitoring that we're doing, that if somebody is having that problem or having a struggle in the classroom because they can't keep on top of marking, well, again, let's try and create some space to allow them to actually catch up a little bit, to then get back to a position where they're not treading water, and that they, you know, and feel supported. So yeah, I mean, there is a balance, and I know there are lots of schools that have removed, that go straight in and remove all monitoring. I'm not there yet, but we are moving towards a different.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because when it's high stakes, there's a difference, isn't there, between high stakes accountability and what you're talking about, a supportive model of accountability. And I've just been out for a walk with my brother. It's one of the wonders of not working in a school. I get to go and spend some time with my gorgeous three-year-old niece and my brother. And he works in telecommunications, I think, or something. And he's been doing a job for a while, and he's been doing it temporarily. And he said he'd spoken to his manager and said, do you think I'll be kept on? Because nobody's given me any feedback, and he'd not got any feedback at all. And that's no good either.
No.
People need feedback. They like to know what they're doing well, and they like, most people want to be the best that they can be. So they want the feedback. They do want it. But I think it's like you're saying, it's thinking about, as a leadership team, how you do that in a supportive way. So if you do see something that's not going well in a classroom, that you then go and speak to the person and say, what's happening? Because this wasn't quite right, or that wasn't quite right. And is there something that you want to talk about or tell me? Because, you know, it could be that someone who's always been perfectly good, and you go in and you notice things. So you have to be doing that, and people have to have feedback on their work, because without it they stagnate. So you can't be in an environment where you don't have any monitoring at all, can you?
No, absolutely not. And I think, you know, I think it's really important to just remember that we're human beings dealing with human beings.
Yeah.
And the reason, you know, I talked about high energy, levels of energy required, emotional energy required, because we are dealing with human beings day in, day out, and young people and colleagues. You know, I think not only are we doing the level of planning work, the project work that we have to do, everything else, the academic side of it, but we are dealing with, you know, highly emotive situations on a regular basis. I'm not saying that, you know, that children are highly emotional all the time, but I think, you know, you are every day as a teacher putting yourself in front of a load of young people, and you're taking risks and you're putting yourself out there. And I think that requires a certain level of energy, level of emotional energy to do that, you know, because the risk of making mistakes in the classroom and building those relationships so that you're allowed to do so. And I've always, I mean, I probably a conversation I had with somebody a very long time ago, but there, you know, I think on an individual level, there are three things, aren't there? It's your work life, it's your home life, as in the home, and it's your relationships, your personal life. So if one of those is wobbling, then you've still got the other two that can kind of prop you up. But it's when two or more of those go, and it can happen.
It does happen. I'm evidence of that. And this is one of the things that I always say in terms of my burnout. What happened was sort of my home life and what was going on in work as a deputy. If one was not so good, the other was. And if one, you know, so, but then when they both went, I wasn't particularly happy in my role as a deputy. The school that I was in didn't really suit me as well as it should. And then I separated from my husband, like you're saying. So my relationships, also my personal life, and it was really, really difficult for me. And that's when, and that's the thing, that one of the things that I was thinking about was a lot of leaders say, oh, you know, my door's always open, you know, I promote openness and honesty, and often that's not the way that the staff perceive it. You can say, my door's always open, but if the staff aren't prepared to knock on the door and come in and be open with you, then there's no point in saying that. And you have to create that environment.
You have to create it, and you have to live it. And quite often that's about getting around to other people at the end of the school day, sitting on the table whilst you're having a conversation, checking with them, how are you, good to see you back, you know, and just provide the space and opportunity for people to talk to you in their own comfortable space, so that then when it comes to a point where they do have to come and talk to you, they're more comfortable stepping into your space. Because, you know, I think I'm quite nice as an individual. I think I'm quite funny, but you know, actually what I forget sometimes is the title on my door. The fact I'm head teacher brings a whole level of you know, social constructed kind of expectations, you know, and I have to remember that sometimes, you know. Sometimes I say things and think, should I?
You're the head teacher.
Was that professional? was I professional enough in that moment? But I think there's got to be a certain level of you know, authenticity. You've got to be yourself.
Yeah.
Yes, of course you've got to be professional. But you've got to do it in a way that, you know, people are still seeing the real you as well.
Being authentic and vulnerable.
And also think sometimes as leaders, because it's all very well, we are talking about colleagues, and of course my job is to have my door open for my colleagues, but sometimes you also need to protect yourself. You know, you need to be ready for those difficult conversations that you've got to have, you know. And if you know that you've already got a diary with a parent meeting with complaints, you know you're going to have that difficult conversation over there, don't book another one in over there, because you just have, you know, you've got to protect your own emotional energy and your own well-being as well.
Yeah, and I think as a coach, I've experienced this with a number of the women leaders that I've worked with. And I'm not saying it's just women, don't get me wrong, you know, men can be very empathetic, and but I think as women, we want to be helping all the time. And I've come across women who, you know, that door's been open, and that's caused a lot of stress, because you spend a lot of time dealing with staff, and then you've got other workload things. So you can't have an open door policy, can you, where it's okay for people to just come and interrupt you whenever it is throughout the day. You have to be able to, like you're saying, plan for that and organize it. What do you do if someone comes to your door and you're in the middle of something? How do you go about sort of creating?
Well, it depends what it is. I mean, people do come in and just need a quick minute with me, you know, and if I have it, I will give it. If I haven't got it, I will tell them that I really want to give them the time that whatever that it deserves. So, and I've got this deadline to meet, so can I arrange to see you when I'm free at 3:30, for example? So, you know, I think you have to, I've got a good PA as well, always helps. So I think it's important to be available, but not necessarily instantly available.
Sometimes
it's about having those conversations, you know, especially if it stops you in a corridor, or is to say, look, you know, you're very clearly upset, I can see that. Now is probably not the time to do it, because I can't give you the time that this deserves. So can you see Hazel and set up a meeting so that we can actually sit down and have a proper chat?
Yeah.
And I think that's also very helpful, because people obviously, they come to you when they're in a heightened emotional state sometimes.
Yeah.
And if you give people the space to actually calm down a little bit and actually really get to grips with what's really bothering them, you know, if you give a bit of space to it, actually you can have a more informed, sensible discussion when it is time to, you know, when you can create that space to have that conversation.
I think that's really, really good advice, actually, Bianca. Yeah, that you don't have to have the conversation with the person there and then.
No.
And I think often sometimes we feel compelled to, that, you know, this person is standing in front of me and yet I've got this other thing going on. But as long as you make it clear to that person that you have got time for them and when that's going to be, that's a really good piece of advice. Now, you must have a lot of staff because you work in quite a unique school, don't you? Because it's an all through school. So what challenges does that create for you?
Well, we've got 94. The challenge, I suppose, at the moment is that we've got our first year six coming up into year seven this year. So, you know, we've really got to get that truly all through bit right. I think, you know, we don't want it to be, the trust or me, we don't want it to be two separate schools within a site that looks like an all through but isn't. So for us, it's mapping, it's really getting people together and mapping those conversations about curriculum and sequencing and how that goes all the way through. It comes with real benefits because I've got some primary colleagues working on some TLR3 projects this year all through, which has been great. I've got, you know, we have secondary colleagues working with primary pupils, so specialists, which is really good for the young people. We want to develop that further next year, more bespoke CPD. I think the challenge is to make sure that whatever you are working with and planning is that it's appropriate and relevant to all, and you haven't got one or the other sitting thinking, well, this has got nothing to do with me, so why am I here?
Yeah.
Because some of it is all through, but of course, you know, some of it is discreetly to do with secondary phase or primary phase. But I think it's got real benefits, and certainly this year, in particular, CPD programs have been cross-phase, which has been really exciting. It's good, rich dialogue. And I think it's important for secondary colleagues to know where primary colleagues are coming from or have come from in terms of their learning and the other way around. And hopefully we won't have that dip. But ultimately, we're a two form entry primary phase and a four form entry secondary phase. So another challenge is that we're going to have, you know, we're going to have those pupils coming in outside of school as well, so we'll have to work that as well.
But you will get that understanding of the primary curriculum, won't you, that in a lot of high schools there isn't, and there's always, in every high school I've worked, there's always been, I think transition has always posed particular challenges. And I think one of the issues that we've got in high schools is that we've expected too little of pupils on entry into high school. So you won't have that problem, will you? What advice would you give to other schools about transition? What's it teaching you about transition and the important bits that schools need to get right and how they can do that in a better way? Solve all the problems of the world on this podcast. I'm going to call this one Bianca Greenhouse Solves the World's Educational Problems.
I'll let you know. Hold that thought and I'll let you know next year. I think it's just about having high expectations of the young people that come into year seven. There is a lot of work in primary that I think you look at what pupils can write in primary phase and what they produce in secondary phase.
I think sometimes the children come to high school and go, oh my God, woohoo, this is so easy. They don't expect anything like they expected of me at primary school here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think partly, but although we've also got to acknowledge and recognise that quite often work is reworked until it gets to a point. So, their best pieces of work quite often have had several drafts. So, it's having high expectations, really, and working closely with your local primary schools. The difficulty with curriculum is always going to be that different primary schools and secondary schools are going to have different curriculums. But it's about having an awareness of what children learn in primary school, at least, moving forward. Because, you know, when primary children are doing Shakespeare in primary phase, and then they're doing Shakespeare in year seven for English, and then they do something in drama for Shakespeare, but it's a kind of a repeat of what they do in year seven for English. You know, it's really having a good understanding of what other people are doing.
And it's about that knowledge, isn't it? And having a really detailed understanding of what the primary curriculum looks like and knowing exactly what their starting points will be, because if you don't have that knowledge, you're not going to be effective in your KZ3 curriculum.
Also, the early years framework has completely changed. going into next year, and that's the real, you know, that's the real start point for you know what they're expecting from young people there. So
yeah,
it would be useful for people to have an understanding of that.
And do you just got to GCSE? Have you got?
We've not got capacity. Sixth forms are quite expensive for schools. Actually, you have to have a quite a high number of children. We've got capacity for 1,020 here, and we've got local colleges that are outstanding, so that wouldn't be of any benefit to us.
So it will be quite a small community, won't it then?
Yeah, it is. And the thing is, we're on a business park as well, so. In terms of moving forward, our three strategic intents are for our young people to be kind, resilient, and their personal best. It's for our community to feel that the school belongs to them, and it's that the Gatwick School is the school of choice. Because, you know, and it's really important for us to work hard on our community, because the school is small. It feels like a community, but it's in a place that isn't, you've got housing slates near, but it's not it's like I say, it's right in the middle of a business park, so it's quite an unusual site, but exciting opportunities.
I was gonna say, when it comes to careers,
absolutely. we've just gone into partnership with Gatwick Aviation Museum as well, right. Really exciting, so
yeah, that'll be amazing, because I was a careers lead and just thought, oh my goodness, to be on a business park, that would be so tremendous.
Exciting opportunities, but it's COVID has caused some challenges there, but we have managed to, even online, we have an enterprise week whilst we were doing our remote learning, and still had careers events online.
Brilliant.
And other things that were outside of usual curriculum time.
So to finish off, as a relatively new head teacher, what advice? Two things. First of all, how would you sell being a head teacher to a woman who has said she doesn't want to be a head teacher? And secondly, what advice would you give to a new head teacher just to help?
I would say it is the best job in the world. It's challenging, but it is the best job in the world. I absolutely love it. I think you just got to try it. Just, you know, I'm all about, you know, women ed, 10% braver.
Yes.
And I'm making the leap, because, you know, the benefits far outweigh the challenges that it comes with. In terms of advice for a new head teacher, use the support that's around you. Don't try and do everything yourself and be superhuman, because you just can't. And if you haven't got the support around you, find it and ask for it.
Because people are
willing.
I think one of the things we're proving on the podcast is that being a head teacher doesn't have to be a lonely job.
No,
I wondered whether some women don't go into headship because of this myth that being a head teacher is a lonely job. Yeah, it's lonely at the top.
There are moments where it can feel like that, because ultimately you've got to make the final decision. So when it comes to things like permanent exclusions, you know, panels for a range of different, you know, if you're going to take things all the way to panel meetings, you know, all of those decisions, ultimately they fall on you. So it can feel lonely in that sense, because it's got, you know, it's having the confidence, it's not even confidence really, you just have to sit with the decision that you've made and be confident it's the right decision, because we all make decisions based on the information we've got at the time, and sometimes you just got to stand firm in it that based on that moment that was the right decision. A week later you might hear some different information, but it doesn't matter because you didn't have that then. So I think in that sense it can feel like that, but actually if you've got a good network of people around you that you can sound out if you are making a decision that is difficult, then it makes it easier, because, you know, ultimately you still have to decide yourself, and you will get a range of different views on what you're doing, but it just helps you, it helps you have an informed decision then, I think.
Yeah. And what's next for you?
Oh, blimey, well, get this school right. What's next for me? A holiday in a couple of weeks. I want to be a, you know, I came into teaching to be a head. There were times where I wasn't sure I wanted to do it, but I've continued. I now want to be a CEO.
Yeah.
Not stopping here, but I'm not in a rush either. I've got a lot of work to do first.
Brilliant. Thanks so much for joining us.
No, thank you very much for having me.
If people want to see what you're doing and keep an eye on you, where can they do that?
So it's at BC Greenhouch, which is on Twitter. You can find me on LinkedIn, Bianca Greenhouch, as well.
Brilliant. Well, go and enjoy the sunshine this weekend. It's going to be a scorcher. By the time the podcast goes out, it's probably cold and grey and raining again. I make a podcast, and then by the time it comes around, I think, oh well, it's completely different circumstances now.
Things happen when they happen.
Take care, Bianca.
Right, you too. Thank you for your time.
That was such a great conversation. We covered so much ground. I just want to say thanks to Bianca just for her honesty and openness in that interview. It was a real insight into what it's like in your first year as a head teacher. However, I have to say, she doesn't actually sound like she's in her first year of being a head. There's so much wisdom there, and it seems like she's got so much experience. It does actually feel, or it did feel in the interview, like I was talking to a very experienced head, which I think is absolutely brilliant, and it sounds like she's doing a really good job there. So some of the takeaways from that for me, first of all, the discussion about performance management and making that meaningful is so important, and it's come up so often on the podcast, this idea of making sure that performance management is not just a set of hoops to jump through, because that's just wasting everybody's time. So make it something that contributes towards the growth and development of staff so that they become better at their job, whether that's teaching or leadership, so that they can have more of an impact on the lives of the pupils and the outcomes for the pupils. And at the end of the day, that's what's important. So when you create your performance management system, you must bear that in mind, that you are creating this system to improve the outcomes for the pupils. And it keeps coming up again and again on the podcast about impact. What will the impact be of these actions that you are going to take? If there's no impact on the outcomes for the pupils, then don't do it. If there is significant impact on the well-being of staff, then don't do it. I think they're just two key things to take from that. So make your performance management meaningful, link it into professional development in some way, and make it mean something to the members of staff who are doing it. And don't overface yourself with it either. You know, make it manageable. Often I found performance management was something that seemed like a huge job that had to be done in October. And then when we came back to it again, it felt like there was a lot of pressure to do it. So think about how you're going to make it work as well and how you're going to make it manageable. One of the other things that she talked about was if you're in a leadership role, you have to be ready for difficult conversations. And that goes without saying. If you are a leader, you are going to have some conversations that make you feel uncomfortable. What I like to do is not describe them as difficult or challenging conversations. And I've had a couple of coaching sessions this week with female school leaders about this very thing. And I prefer to call those conversations curious conversations, conversations in which you are trying to find things out. So before you have a conversation like that, think about what it is you want to know. Make a list of the questions that you want to ask and approach it in a curious way. And finally, I just want to talk about this idea that Bianca raised of emotional energy. And that really, to me, is the key to well-being. Have your staff got the emotional energy to do what they need to do on a day-to-day basis? If they don't have the emotional energy to cope with what's being thrown at them in the day-to-day workings of the school, then their well-being is not good and you need to do something about it. So keep an eye on the emotional energy of your school. And one of the key things with this as well, and it links into this, is the idea of the open door policy. I speak to so many people when I'm coaching or doing my group coaching programs, when people who are in leadership positions want to have an open door policy. And I think this is brilliant. They want a sense of openness in their school. They want people to be able to come to them and to say, I need to talk to you, or I need to tell you about something, or can I ask you something? And that's really, really good. But as a leader, what you have to remember is that you only have so much emotional energy as well. And if your door is constantly open, if you've constantly got members of staff coming in to ask you things, to chat to you about things, that will have an impact on your emotional energy. And it will also have an impact on your workload, because while your door is open and you are having those conversations, the other things that you need to do as part of your role are not being done. And that's when you have to work 60 or 70 hour weeks. So you need to think carefully about your open door policy. So you need to manage it, and you need to think about how you are going to manage your open door policy so that staff know when you're available and when you're not available. And one of the ways that you can keep on top of it is to, like Bianca says, at the end of the day, get round to people and ask them how they are and have some of those conversations at that time of the day. Get to know people so that they know that there is openness and honesty, that that is part of the culture in the school. Because you do have to create that culture first before staff will get a sense that that's how things work. When you have got that culture and you've created that culture, you then need to think about how you are going to manage it so that you can look after your own well-being and your own emotional, your emotional energy. So just as a final reminder, the advice for new heads that Bianca gave, she said, have a coach. Really important. Obviously, I'm going to say that, but she says it. She says it's been really important to her. Join networks. Be part of networks. Try not to do everything at once, and don't try to do everything yourself. When you need help, ask for it. So that was a really great interview with Bianca. Thank you. I just want to say thank you to her so much for taking the time in a really busy schedule to talk to us today. So my next cohorts for my Women Leaders Group coaching programs are going ahead this month. We are totally full now, but there will be another cohort starting in January. So if you would like to join us on those programs, and the feedback that we've had from them has been absolutely amazing. If you would like to join us, do get in touch with me. You can do that via the website, where you can book a chat with me to talk about what the Women Leaders Group coaching program might be able to offer you. So that's transformeducationcoach.com. You can join the Facebook group, the We Lead Well Facebook group. It would be great to see you in there. Or you can join the Women Lead Well Network, which is a network of women leaders. We have a monthly group coaching call, and we have a fortnightly coach's couch, where you can bring anything that you want to bring to that session to be coached about. And we have a network of women leaders in all different phases and all aspects of leadership roles in schools. So if you would like to join that network, get in touch with me either via the website, or you can find me on Twitter and LinkedIn. And like I said, you can join the Women Lead Well Network on Facebook. So I just want to apologize finally, as we come to the end of the show, for my lateness in getting this podcast out, but I have had COVID. So I am joining the legions of people who have now had COVID. I can say I was double vaccinated, but it still really actually surprisingly knocked me for six. I was quite ill with it. So that did surprise me after being double vaccinated. But I'm hoping now that I'm going to be super protected because I'm double vaccinated and I've had the virus. So hopefully that's me and COVID done for now. Well, that's all we've got time for today. Thank you so much for listening. I know we've got lots of listeners out there who listen religiously to every episode, and I do want to thank you for your support and for listening to the show. I hope that you're enjoying it, and I hope that it's helping you to grow and develop your leadership in some way. So I will speak to you next time. In the meantime, take care of yourself, take care of your staff, and lead well. This episode of the We Lead Well podcast was brought to you in partnership with Transform Education Coaching, headteacherchats.com, and the Teach Well Alliance.